Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
This is KBOO Portland.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning into KBOO Community Radio this morning, and in particular to our Thursday morning talk radio. I'm your host, Linda Olson Osterlund, and I have a great topic for us today. This is a call-in show, so you will be invited to call in. If you want to write the number down now, you can. It's 503-231-8187. Hold off on the calls till we have a few minutes to talk with our guest. His name is Michael German. You may have heard him before on an interview with me about a month ago about his book. His second book is the title is Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide: How the New FBI Damaged Democracy. So we talked about that book, and you can look that up on the web under his name, Mike German, or my name, Linda Olson Osterlund, and a link will come up to that show if you'd like to hear that. In that book, he talked about Mueller, the famous Mueller report, and Comey, names we've heard about. And it occurred to me that in this time when our Attorney General is appearing to be doing the bidding of the president directly rather than looking at cases in justice. So I thought this is the perfect person to have on. So welcome to KBOO, Mike.
Thanks a lot for having me again.
Yeah, I'm really happy to have you. I also want, you know, we can let them know that they can find your work on The Guardian. I believe you've been in the Cipher Brief and Defense One, and you wrote a help write a screenplay, I hear. Is that right?
That's right. A film called The Imperium.
Yeah.
That starred Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah, well, that's kind of exciting. I know another person in a different profession who also has gotten into writing for movies, so fairly interesting. I think creative people are often creative in different ways. But let's get to talking about Barr. He continues to stir things up, or his boss continues to stir things up. And I remember being, when he tried to intervene on the Stone, so we should give people a little bit of facts. Stone is a man who was associated with the president, longtime friend of his, and Roger Stone, and he faced trial in New York in federal court for crimes related to, I believe, the Russia investigation. And President Trump tweeted directly in opposition to his sentencing. And the very next day, within 24 hours, our attorney general had weighed in and attempted to change that, to say that sentencing was inappropriate. And within a very short time, the four prosecutors on the case withdrew and resigned from the Justice Department. That's quite a lot of stirring up that's going on. And I thought you could give us a more insider's perspective. And a long-term, 17 years in the FBI and a long time observing the justice system. So why don't you just weigh in a little bit about what kind of role is this attorney general playing, and is it appropriate what he's doing, and how common is it in our history?
So it's very inappropriate to be engaged in politicizing criminal cases. This is Roger Stone's involvement, was involved with the campaign, and when questioned by Congress, gave false answers. So that prosecution was following the traditional protocols. There are written sentencing guidelines, and those guidelines were supposed to help judges make sentences uniform across the country, so we don't have somebody charged with the same crime in New Jersey facing very different penalties from somebody who might be charged with that crime in Oregon. And the prosecutors, who were all very experienced Department of Justice employees, used the guidelines, and I think there are many people, including the judge, even said this, who think the guidelines are too severe in many cases, but they recommended a sentence that was approaching 9 years.
Right. And even if they think those guidelines are severe, the guidelines are in place now. It would be up to a new an AG to issue new guidelines, and that's a big thing usually, right?
Right. Certainly there is more than enough room for criminal justice reform. The problem here is that as Attorney General, Bill Barr has been very aggressive in wanting other people sentenced harshly, and the full weight of the law coming down on people. So it really stood out when a friend of the president was treated very differently, and the Attorney General required that the sentencing memo be withdrawn. And that's when the four prosecutors resigned from the case. Only one actually resigned from the Justice Department so far.
From the case. And then right. Within days, 1,100 members of the an organization, I'm not seeing the name of it right here, but these are all former DOJ officials who they say, "We proudly took an oath to support and defend our Constitution and faithfully execute the duties of our office. The very first of these duties is to apply the law equally to all Americans. This obligation flows directly from the Constitution and is embedded in countless rules and laws governing the conduct of the DOJ lawyers. The Justice Manual, the DOJ's rulebook for its lawyers, states that, quote, the rule of law depends on the even-handed administration of justice, end quote, and that the department's legal decisions, quote, must be impartial and insulated from political influence. I think right there is the crux of the matter. And I know growing up for me, Mike, I thought that was the way it was supposed to be. I learned as I went through life that this isn't the way our system has ideals, and it has them written and in coded in law, but that doesn't mean that's the way it always goes. Often the rich seem to get off easier on almost everything. You know, and that can go from being in a small town with a county judge to a big city. It seems that I would be willing to bet that most Americans who live under poverty level would say that justice is not even-handed. Nonetheless, is it important for us to continue to uphold the appearance of, you know, of not being influenced by political biases or outside influence?
Absolutely it is. And again, I think we need to look at this issue a little more broadly and realize that this is not something that is brand new. It's been happening for some time. And while you're absolutely correct, what Bill Barr and President Trump are doing is so overt that it's really undermining the concept of equal justice. The idea that the Justice Department was pristine and always reliably equal-handed in how it handled cases is far from the truth. And we have to remember that, you know, it was the George W. Bush Justice Department that authorized torture and warrantless spying on Americans, and the Obama Justice Department that authorized the extrajudicial killing even of American citizens. The problem is these decisions have been made in the dark, and keep in mind it goes way back, right? I mean, it was Bill Clinton's Justice Department that wrote the Office of Legal Counsel memo that prevented Robert Mueller from writing an indictment of President Trump for obstruction of justice. So
you know, White Houses tend to protect themselves, don't they, no matter who is at the head of them?
Exactly.
And they keep pushing it forward to increase their power for secrecy and protection rather than... I think the Justice Departments have been doing that. I think you're very right about that.
Right. So it's not a matter of getting rid of Donald Trump and Bill Barr. There has to be a much deeper examination of how the Justice Department, particularly this Office of Legal Counsel that writes the internal rules for the Justice Department, actually for the whole nation, it does that in a way that's completely undemocratic and not subject to public examination. And that needs to be changed.
No oversight and knowledge of does this meet what we see as our needs. You know, in this time when it appears that, you know, and many people are writing about that Trump is really shaking up not just the Justice Department, but the intelligence community, and in part by understaffing, which he's doing throughout the whole administration, and seems to be a very clear policy of his that if you understaff, you have more control and you can put unqualified people who may be your people in positions of power. And it seems like this is the kind of thing that this is really getting to people. It's like it's stepped over a line for many people. The other thing that Barr did was he stopped the Mueller investigation from being reported properly. He initiated a report before Mueller could, and that report was inaccurate enough that Mueller came out in public and said it was inaccurate. What do you think about that disagreement and what went on there? You have experience. I know when Mueller's in favor with the media, they like to say he's a man of the highest integrity, but I also know that he worked to cover up some knowledge about the 9/11 people when it was pushed up the chain through the FBI and he found out about it. He pushed back and said, don't tell anybody. And so he's not all Mr. Integrity and keep the public informed properly. So how do you see this thing with Mueller and Barr? And I also read somewhere that they were supposedly best buddies since the 80s. They go fishing together. Their families hang out.
Right. Both had come up through the Justice Department over decades, and both had been involved in cases like the Bank of Commerce and Credit International, a huge bank fraud and money laundering investigation that the FBI conducted, and was many people alleged put down by the Justice Department because it might implicate the CIA and other government intelligence programs, because these agencies were using this bank as well.
You know, it's a good point to put in right now that William Barr did work for the CIA early in his career. I think it was 6 years.
Right.
Yeah, just to throw in there, I mean, he's been all over the intelligence, and you know, I mean, this man is deeply embedded inside our system with the different jobs that he has done.
Right, and you know, this concept of a unitary executive, the idea that the president is all powerful, is very dangerous to our system. That it's based on a balance of powers between three co-equal branches of government, and when you have one that believes that it's no longer answerable to Congress, you know, that's where we ran into problems with the Attorney General not letting executive branch officials testify before Congress, when that's Congress's role, is to oversee the way that executive branch is enforcing the law. So it creates a breakdown in our system that undermines not just its effectiveness, but the way it interacts with the public, and it actually undermines democracy.
Yeah, it's pretty clear in that case with the impeachment trials that having the witnesses that were, you know, being called for by both sides supposedly was, you know, strictly up to whether the president would allow them to. Now, I would also say it was up to them to not, they didn't have to obey his orders to not speak. They were subpoenaed. The legal thing for them would still have been to respond. And so their loyalty to the president, to an illegal, you know, and I don't know, or extra legal order to not respond to the subpoenas, I think, you know, showed... he's good at scaring people into being very, very loyal to him, or only having very, very loyal people around him. And I think that's a very dangerous situation that we're in right now.
And you know, Congress has been lax about protecting federal government whistleblowers.
That's right.
And so, you know, we were in this sad situation where members of Congress were practically begging the president not to retaliate against those who chose to testify, because they had not passed a law that would actually protect them. And we saw right after the impeachment hearings were over that retaliation did occur. And,
retaliation against families. I'm not going to say
exactly
his name. One of them had a twin brother who also was fired at the same time, as if they are one person instead of two individuals who worked in that employee. Let me go back.
And there's a broader effort to purge
anyone
the civil service agencies and the intelligence community of people who Trump believes are disloyal to Trump. Not disloyal to the country, mind you, but disloyal to the president himself. And that is a severe breach of the norms of civil service.
And when the DOJ is so clearly under his thumb or doing his bidding, it means we don't have an important part of the government that can provide, some stop on this, something that has more adherence to the rule of law literally than perhaps the president does in his thinking. He's also most recently threatened the main juror forewoman on the Stone trial. And the judge there has taken Trump to task about that. But tweeting about this individual juror and, publicly castigating, I feel this aspect of the president is also extremely dangerous. He by his role, intimidates people. You have the highest, most powerful position in our country, and you call people names in a public setting where you know that many of the people that he calls out gets thousands of letters of hate and, threats of violence against their lives. I feel like he's interfering directly in that case by attempting to intimidate the juror. I mean, why isn't that case thrown out now? Why is that not a mistrial?
So that's actually, so part of the, with the Stone trial, Stone had already been convicted, and this was just the sentencing phase where these tweets were coming out. But it is a significant problem. I mean, I worked on cases where just that the president mentioned the case became subject of defense motions trying to undermine the prosecution. So, we're so far beyond what normal behavior of the president in these situations are, where it's very clear not just that the president is publicly giving his viewpoint, but rather that he's actually trying to change the outcomes of these investigations and prosecutions.
And I do believe he knows he's rallying his troops of trolls, the people who will just do online hate for him. When he does these kinds of things, because there's enough evidence, the people who are the recipients of that kind of, he can really shut down somebody with his amount of, he doesn't have to do it, he just has to be, enthusiastically belligerent and say something like, they ought to be off the air, or they should not, he says very threatening things that I think could be interpreted legitimately as threats to people, including the woman who was our... Yeah, he sounds like a thug when you hear that tape of him talking about Abramovich, I think is her name, the ambassador to the Ukraine, who he set people up to follow and surveil. At the least, that was what they were doing to her. And that's one of his own employees. If he was unhappy with her, he could have phoned her and said, "You're fired." He didn't have to.
And keep in mind, and I think it's important to keep in mind that this isn't coming from a place of knowledge, of understanding the policy and seeking to reform the policy. It's just who he determines are his friends and his enemies.
Yes.
And that's quite problematic, because we're not talking about a legal system anymore, but an authoritarian system that is just based on the will of the president.
Yes. Well, I want to let the callers know it's a great time to dial up and call in. The number is 503-231-8187. Let's hear what you've been thinking about this Attorney General Barr. Has it been just no surprise to you, or has each next step bothered you more? Do you think it's important that we're focusing on it? And if I haven't brought up enough to tweak your interest, he also goes around the country speaking on religious matters. Taking to task the government and other things for religious matters. He most recently, discussed the current situation in religious terms, basically talking to religious broadcasters and telling them their role was to counter the bad role that all other mainstream and other media do, because the importance of religion in society as a pillar of religion and religious ideals being those that help drive, community life. I hadn't realized he was such a strong evangelist religious person, but apparently he has been speaking regularly on these topics. That frightens me a little bit more because there is a large number of people in the military who are members or associated with a group that used to be called the family, and it's all about they think in the military they're carrying out the will of God, and so God's behind them when they go and kill people, and they literally are quotes from generals and stuff saying, well, it isn't bad if God wants you to do it, and God wants you to do it because it's us.
Right, and particularly problematic when that military is fighting in countries that aren't Christian and therefore brings in that religious element into the conflict.
And so we see our president in India, as there are huge riots against a new totalitarian state there under Modi. And our president is over there patting him on the back and telling him what a great job he's doing. Sometimes
right, in the midst of an anti-Muslim riot.
Yeah, well, and the largest one that ever has been. It's a massacre. There's going to be so many people dead. It's very sad and very distressing. And yet that is clearly who Trump likes best, is he likes dictators who clamp down hard. He's even, I think, been quoted saying something about the one in the Philippines. So we've got that kind of problem going on. So we haven't got any callers yet. Callers, call in 503-231-8187. What else would you like to say about this whole situation with Barr? And what do you think, is there anything that can be done until the election?
Oh, you're asking me that?
Yeah.
I think it's difficult now. I don't understand the strategy of the quick impeachment and the narrow impeachment. It seems that there's a lot of different things that the president and his staff have been involved in, particularly his family, that require deeper investigation.
Yes.
Yeah, obviously, Congress has the power to do those investigations. And, when Robert Mueller was first named as special counsel, I wrote a piece arguing that, while he's certainly competent to do that kind of investigation, he doesn't have a perfect record of exposing government wrongdoing, and that Congress should have kept up their investigation rather than waiting for his investigation to end, because that would create a time crunch. And I think that time crunch has unfortunately put us in a position where there's not much that can be done before the elections. Obviously, the elections are going to be very important. But what we've seen from this president, with the support of his attorney general, is that when his wrist is slapped for some misconduct, he doesn't withdraw, but rather goes forward more aggressively with other
efforts. Absolutely.
I mean, the Ukrainian crisis came about just as the Mueller report was released, and of course Bill Barr's false characterization of that as an exoneration of Trump.
That was one of his main roles, wasn't it, to really recast the Mueller report in a way that hoped would, and certainly with the media that they use, some of the mass media that's in particular the right's use, it just got hammered over and over and over again, that there was
right.
nothing
and keep in
mind there.
That Bill Barr got that position because he had written an unsolicited memo explaining how the Mueller investigation was untenable. So it was pretty clear, and yet, and I think this is where one of the problem is, that Congress has for decades not been as effective as a check on presidential powers as it should be.
Yes.
And that has been a voluntary withdrawal to where, again, you know, you have these members of Congress just begging the president to behave rather than having
any power over him, any, you know, even just the influence of what's right and wrong. Hey, we do have a couple callers on the line. I'd like to get to Sean. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. Wow, a lot of points to make here. Yeah, so, I mean, the thing just with Mueller, I never thought anything would come out of it just because he was on that. Not surprising to hear how connected they are. My couple of points are, you mentioned the family, and I want to recommend a great book that Jeff Charlotte wrote years ago on that very topic called
The Family. Yes, there's an interview in the KABU archives if you want to find that one. Jeff Charlotte, Charlett, I interviewed him on The Family, his book.
Yeah, it's a really important point because, you know, I don't believe, I mean, this is not the first time that Barr should go around acting as though he's a born-again Christian of some kind, when really it's just he's just using it as a dog whistle to that very base, which ties into another thing that, you know, under the dictatorship in Portugal years ago, the whole thing of, if you're familiar with fado music, came out of Portugal, and it was used cryptically to speak out against the what they considered the dictatorship, which is under the guise of God, country, and militarism. And that's the very thing that you see going on, excuse me, right now. And really what I want to tie it all into is, if you look at who their focus is, who their base is, and also all this cutting back of resources, even into the intelligence agencies and so forth, even though they get a tremendously insane amount of money, but overall, that Trump is now, they've voted in the Space Force and now going after social services, but cutting back the CDC and so forth, is really about going to fund the Space Force. But it's also about undermining, like, the coronavirus. You know, if that's something that takes over, ultimately it's about weakening people. And if you're putting the sources into God, country, militarism, that's how you get a bigger base of an authoritarian regime. So I see the whole thing as connected.
I've heard many people be concerned about that the coronavirus is somehow connected to the political things that are going on, and that it's not just an accident. But, you know, I haven't seen any influence.
I don't believe it's like, you know, it's a biological warfare kind of thing. I think it's very real. But I think the fact that he wants to downplay it and has cut back the CDC at the same time says a lot. Why would you do that? What would be the basis for doing that? What's the long-term, what's the ideology that's behind that? I mean, otherwise anybody thinks that's just absolutely insane. Number one, of course, all he cares about is the market. All he cares about is money. But if you're trying to gain power individually, and always dictatorships and authoritarian rule work hand-in-hand with whoever the so-called ruler is, works hand-in-hand with the military. So, but if you can, anything that can weaken people as well very much supports the very premise of what they're about. Anyway, that's the way I see it.
Go ahead.
Right, and a lot of it is about driving public fear, moving from crisis to crisis. Exactly. That distracts people from doing kind of inquiry that would reveal the corruption behind it.
Yeah, and not too long ago, if you remember, I can't remember who stated it, but it was like a couple of months ago, that an official came out and said, you know, what they really loved about Trump is he was great at distracting people, literally not being unapologetic, as, you know, it allows them to go about doing their damage by being such a great distractor. And that's what they really loved about him. So,
right.
Anyway.
And, you know, I don't think it takes any genius. I think these are our old habits of authoritarians that come naturally.
Statement that I heard years ago too, it really just stuck with me, that it is all about God, country, and militarism, and those are their dog whistles. And I don't believe Barr for a second. He uses it as a crutch, just like, you know, Harvey Weinstein uses his fake walker to gain sympathy. You know, I mean, it's
right.
Well, I think he's also activating a certain base, though. When he goes around and speaks for, you know, basically as an the attorney general. I mean, that's what he is when he's there. And he speaks about this conservative religious and goes after the media. He's also echoing his boss and enlivening the base. I mean, these are basically these could be considered campaign talks in that way.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, again, you know, that whole thing of not only in Charlotte's book, but also, you know, in the book, again, I think I've mentioned to you, Linda, is that, you know, the book written 10 years ago, Top Secret America, it discussed
yes.
the very thing of not only the growth of the system that is all about essentially policing and supporting an authoritarian rule.
And that book is by William Arkin.
How much the religion and the people who were within the Air Force and even now in our government, Pence, are the very people who are truly religious, how much they follow this very extreme conservative view about God and, you know, our exceptionalism and so forth.
You know, I don't know, but I do know from that book, the family, that that Hillary Clinton used to get down on her knees and pray next to conservative senators every morning when the Senate was in. She and others did. So, you know, the people that pray together maybe stay together. I don't know, but I do know that was part of it.
The people you don't think who were maybe so involved in it, it's no different than in the book I've mentioned, Democracy Now. I mean, Democracy in Chains, is the discussion about all these people otherwise you wouldn't know who go to these symposiums and these meetings and so forth for this very thing on neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. Run by the Koch brothers and now strictly by Charles Koch, you know, that you never hear about. You never hear about these these religious meetings that and a lot of politicians who otherwise you would think of as progressive and so forth, but it's to try to get them to see their side of things and come onto their side. And he does it based upon a great degree. It's all about they know how much self-interest plays a part in this, and they need to either go along or they will do everything in their power to get them out of office.
Yep. Yeah. Well, thank you, Sean. I'm going to let you go. We have another caller on the line. It's Edie. Edie, before you start talking, I'd like to mention that I recall historically, and I want to ask you about this, Mike, that it used to be that when you came into the presidency, you requested the firing of all the appointed officials within the Department of Justice, and you requested their resignations. They turned in your resignations. Then you selected your attorney general, and some of those, certainly the long-term career people, most of them came back in, but it allowed them to sort of bring in a new Justice Department. And I noticed that when Obama came in, he did not do that. He took on and accepted the Justice Department that had been formed under Alberto Gonzalez and under Bush, which was a very different Justice Department. Something like 190 of its employees had come straight out of strict religious colleges. They were purposely hiring under Alberto Gonzalez, and they hired hundreds of them. So not purging that system in the way that was normal within our system seems to have left a lot of dangerous to my point of view, especially when they come out of religious colleges, religious law colleges. Talk about that a little bit, and then we'll get Edie online.
Sure. So it actually is. It's unusual to do a political purge. So when Bill Clinton was elected, he requested the resignations of all the U.S. attorneys, just the top political appointee in each district. And that was seen as an overreach. It was
really
normal
It
was normal that many would be asked, but a blanket everyone.
Yeah,
was unusual. But and again, it was just the top person in each office, the political appointee that led the office.
Uh-huh.
It was normal. There was a lot of natural turnover, usually Republican appointee didn't want to work for a Democratic. You know, there's a natural sort of the political people come and go with the administration.
Right.
But it was something that happened over time. It wasn't instantly. That was a problem under the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration as well. But then the George W. Bush administration did something highly unusual, which in addition. in addition to firing the U.S. attorney had been appointed by Clinton, a couple of years into the administration, went after U.S. attorneys that were not sufficiently aggressive in the president's idea of what needed to be done at the Justice Department. And there was a political purge, as well as this political hiring, where for civil service positions, people were being vetted to see if they were true Bushies.
Right.
As the terminology was used. So that was quite unusual. So when Obama came in, you know, the problem with politicizing the civil service of the Justice Department that way is that any attempt to correct it is seen as just an additional politicization in the opposite direction.
Yeah, but that's so when that's when I always wish that sometimes the Democrats had a little of, what do we call them, cojones.
Right. And keep in mind, you know, part of the problem was that Obama kept the political appointees as well. John Brennan, who he had as National Security Advisor and then CIA Director, was a Bush administration person.
Yeah, he's one of the ones that took down Yemen.
Robert Gates.
Yeah.
Right. So when people were expecting to see big changes, particularly in areas they were concerned about with intelligence community abuses and military abuses, it was all the same people.
How are they going to reform the agency that they had let in abuses?
Yeah.
Well, Mike, we've got some more callers on the line. Let's get them on. Edie, hi.
Hello. I have some local two things that we can do related to the same of this fascist control using fear, confusion, dishonesty, crises, and divisiveness. So we have today at 1 o'clock in the federal courthouse a trial trying to destroy the Relocation Act against renters. And then we have in the Multnomah County Courthouse the Venus Five, those who are trying to correlate the rights of indigenous people, frontline communities, workers.
They blocked the pipeline right down here, and right?
There are oil bomb trains taking Alberta tar sands to Portland, which could create hundreds of miles of destruction just from the explosion.
So what time is their court case?
Well, this court case, the Zenith 5 court case is continuing in Multnomah County, I think in room 538. Today will be the last day. Today, starting at 1 o'clock in the federal courthouse, is the trial of the landlord associations against the city of Portland and against all tenants, having justice that if you are evicted without cause,
they have to pay relocation.
The new law is that they have to be able to pay a teeny part of what it costs you to relocate. You still have a net loss. Sunday at 3:15 in the most northern part of Waterfront Park on the west side near the Steel Bridge will be a rally and solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en. And that is a case where Canadians and people around the world said we want to end the fossil fuel. The most dangerous of all of them is Alberta tar sands. You can see.
Right, this is in support of the native struggle that's going on up there right now.
And they're just as all fascists and dictators use. They will militarize the police. They brutalize. They use rape as a weapon against the women. They separate children from families, and they silence.
Edie, what time is the press. Sunday? What time is this?
Sunday, 3:15.
Okay. So I'm going to quick wrap that up. It's going to be
Sunday, 3:15, west side of the Waterfront Park near the Steel Bridge, the most northern part.
Right.
Please bring signs in solidarity with Wet'suwet'en. It correlates everything from democracy, free speech, water, environment, climate, indigenous rights, you name it, across the board. And then also, we can vote for city council member position 2, Polo or Renault Catalani, because you only have all these different languages and all the countries.
I love running. I didn't know Polo was running.
He is awesome.
I'd vote for him in a heartbeat. Well, yeah. So you know what? I'm going to get back to our main topic, though, now, Edie. I appreciate you calling in.
We're talking about being a Muslim and stopping this us versus them and the violence. He has solutions for police accountability. He has solutions on that stop that.
He's
that hate-mongering and fear-mongering.
He's a very good influence for the community and should be. I would vote for him in a heartbeat, like I said, but I didn't realize he was running. Oh, I can't endorse people. I don't endorse him. I haven't even looked at who's running, so I won't officially endorse him. I would say in a past life I would have voted for him in a heartbeat. Now I'm going to let you go,
Edie.
When
you're not representing cable.
Right. I'm going to let you go, Edie. Thank you very much for calling in. We have Pear online. Thank you for listening and holding on, Pear. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm wondering, I think Attorney General Barr was supposed to be investigating the background to the going to the FISA court. Can you say anything about that?
Sure. So there was an inspector general review of the FBI's investigation of Trump campaign officials and former campaign officials like Carter Page that found some serious deficiencies in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court process, particularly in the accuracy of the affidavits used to obtain the orders necessary to do wiretaps and other searches. And that's been a problem for as long as the FISA court has existed. And it's important that get a lot of attention. And I think that the inspector general did a fine job in that report. But the inspector general concluded that these were not based on bias, but rather just errors. That are common to the system, and unfortunately, the way that the president has characterized it is that this is all a result of anti-Trump bias. Which, if you know anything about the FBI, you know, they were it not for James Comey, you know, the President Trump might not even be president. You know, the idea that this very conservative community was somehow in favor of Hillary Clinton is a little bit laughable. Obviously, there were some people who were not fond of President Trump, but as a whole, you know, dark conspiracy, I think there was no basis for that. But unfortunately, Bill Barr has initiated an investigation using a longtime Justice Department official, John Durham, to do that investigation that is investigating FBI agents. And that type of internal inquisition creates a chilling effect, making it that hard for agents to feel comfortable following evidence where it leads. That, you know, if you know that investigating anybody who's a friend of the president will result in you being investigated yourself, it's easier to say, well, I'm not going to follow that evidence. I'm going to stay away from that, and thereby create a protective ring around the president and his cronies. And that's exactly what we don't want from the Justice Department. But unfortunately, these are concepts of independence of the Justice Department are based on norms built up over decades, and unfortunately what we've seen is those are easily dispensed with when you have a president that's not afraid of that criticism and an attorney general willing to execute his orders.
Is that investigation still going on or what? I haven't heard anything about it.
Yes, it's still going on, and apparently the attorney general himself is deeply involved in that investigation, which is another bad sign, right? The attorney general is a political appointee. He should let career officials address these crimes, and particularly when picking a special investigator like John Durham, the idea that the attorney general is then personally involved creates a perception of bias in the investigation from the beginning.
Yeah, because outside is supposed to stay outside. It's not
exactly
an internal. So do you think the I mean, the issues around the FISA court are a lot. It seems like whenever it's looked at, the FISA court really never says no to whatever kind of request is put to them. And so I find trouble understanding why what are the reforms that people want to make to it, and why are they upset with Barr for wanting to keep it the way it is? It seems to me that it has worked well for them.
Well, that's the ironic part of it. At the same time, they're criticizing the FISA court. They are asking for a clean reauthorization of the Patriot Act, which expanded the FISA court authorities. So it's not based on any sort of principle. It accepts this concept of an all-powerful executive that right. is contrary to our system of government. So they don't want to give up any power, even though they want to be able to cow the judicial branch and the legislative branch into compliance simply through public criticism. So they're using this to beat up the legal system so people no longer can trust the system and have to put their faith in the authoritarian president.
Yeah, I don't think I'd put my faith in the past FISA court employees. I'm not sure I would. I mean, the people who
right,
put
the, and that's the problem, is that there are real problems with this court. Yeah, there are real problems yeah. in Congress, but we're not getting to the to solving those problems if we're just saying we have to ignore them.
Yes, I agree.
Well, were these FISA allegations, were they based on that so-called Steele dossier?
So the Steele dossier did play a role in it, because the FBI very quickly learned that there were parts of the Steele dossier that weren't accurate, and yet continued to rely on that document. But a lot of it has to do with just the way. So normally, as an FBI agent, if I was going to seek a wiretap on somebody in a criminal case, I would write up an application that laid out all the evidence that provided probable cause to believe this person was committing a crime. I would get that approved at the Justice Department, but I would bring it to a local magistrate. So the agent has control over what the affidavit says. In the FISA system, just this is just the way the Justice Department system set it up, is that the agents will send that information to FBI headquarters, and these headquarters supervisors collect the information and put it into an affidavit that is secretly submitted to the FISA court. So the people with the greatest knowledge of the facts lose control of the affidavit. So it's natural for there to be errors and omissions introduced into what gets submitted to the FISA court, and there's no opportunity for review, because you know, in a criminal search warrant or wiretap affidavit, ultimately that gets released to the defendant. So if there are errors, the defendant's lawyer can beat up the FBI over it. So there's an incentive to make sure you've said everything correctly and explained everything appropriately, where in the FISA system, that never sees the light of day, so it's not so important to cross all the T's and dot all the I's. And that's really been a big part of that system for a long time, and the FBI has repeatedly been caught putting inaccurate information into FISA affidavits, and yet everybody's acting like, oh my gosh, this is the first time we've ever found out. And it must be because of some anti-Trumpism, rather than recognizing this is a systemic problem that requires a systemic solution.
Yes.
Well, I'm kind of waiting to hear, you know, see what if the investigation produces anything. I'm just wondering if there's any kind of a timeline here.
So that's part of the problem, is there isn't a timeline, and that's why it becomes chilling, right? It's just always out there. And you know, typically what I found in my career is if there's evidence of wrongdoing, it usually comes forward fairly quickly, and it's a matter of just putting it in the right order, where you know, here this is in a situation where people aren't required to cooperate with the investigation, right? These are all law enforcement, federal law enforcement officials, so there's there shouldn't be any hesitation in getting what evidence is needed. So the fact that it's taking so long is a pretty clear indication to me that they're not finding what they want, which is this evidence of bias. And I think that's the problem, is that it's being used to stifle internal criticism of the president and potentially stifle internal investigations that may implicate the president or his friends and family, rather than to actually find the truth of any potential internal wrongdoing.
Well, thank you for that information, and thank you for the question, Per. I really appreciate that. I hadn't been thinking that direction and wanted to hear more about that. We have another caller on the line. His name is Bill. Bill, hello? Oops, did we lose you?
Hello?
Hi, is this Bill?
Yes, this
okay,
is Bill.
Okay, Bill, you're on.
Okay, just to quickly run this through, fascinating book titled Compromise, Clinton, Bush, and the CIA, 1994. In Chapter 17, this takes place in 1986, Camp Robinson Army Facility outside of Little Rock, Arkansas. It's a World War II ammo bunker. Oliver North, Bill Clinton, Felix Rodriguez, resident CIA agent Akid Sawata, as agency subcontractor Terry Reed, and the man in charge, alias Robert Johnson, a.k.a. William Barr.
Well, now that's interesting, isn't it? Have you heard of this before?
No, I haven't.
This is a covert operation to remachine off-the-shelf semi-automatic weapons to full automatic and to supply them to the Contras. This was done under the cover of the Arkansas Economic Development and Finance Authority. Barr proceeds to dress down an indignant Bill Clinton, who has been accused of skimming excess profits from the agency. Barr is in charge of the meeting at the bequest of William Casey, who as head of the CIA could not risk being present. As special assistant to Casey, Barr proceeds to inform Clinton that if he wishes to realize his political future, he will play by the rules. He then goes on to explain that with their resources, they can sway elections to their advantage. Compromise, Clinton, Bush, and the CIA, Terry Reed and John Cummings.
Terry Reed?
Terry with a T.
Uh-huh. And John Cummings?
Correct.
Okay, well, thank you for the book. Thanks for the...
It explains a lot of what has happened.
All right. It sounds very interesting, at least. Thank you very much. I want to go on now. I wanted to bring up what some of the people in the letter, some of the judges who wrote the letter to the Justice Department and made the public letter requesting that Barr resign. Some of the things they said, I think, are really important. One of the things they said is that in this letter, let me read from it directly. The more than 1,000 former Justice Department officials, it turned out to be 2003 by the time everyone got signed, officials denounced Barr and the president's interference in the fair administration of justice and accused the attorney general of doing the president's bidding, end quote. Those actions and the damage they have done to the Department of Justice's reputation for integrity and the rule of law require Mr. Barr to resign, they wrote. But because we have little expectation he will do so, it falls to the department's career officials to take appropriate action to uphold their oaths of office and defend nonpartisan apolitical justice. Here they're really calling on all the employees of the justice appointment. They go, we likewise call on the other branches of the government to protect from retaliation those employees who uphold their oaths in the face of unlawful directives. This is a former employee who wrote, the rule of law and the survival of our republic demand nothing less. I'd like you to just sort of weigh in on that, this final, how important this is, and also this call to other, how would that have affected you when you were still within the Justice Department as an FBI agent to hear, a call from these 2,000 people to basically resist, corruptness within and bias within their own departments?
So I do find it a little ironic because what I discovered when I raised concerns about the post 9/11 FBI internally, how weak the whistleblower protections were.
Yes.
And have worked over the last 15 years trying to improve them. And many people who are Justice Department officials, and I assume some of which are on that letter, were resisting those calls to reform the whistleblower protections. The Justice Department has been horrible in resisting those reforms. Again, this isn't something that came out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. This has been a deterioration of systems that are designed to protect us. And when people who are in law enforcement, like I was, aren't allowed to report internal illegality without retaliation, the system can't function properly. So it should be no surprise that when you get malevolent actors like President Trump and Bill Barr, how they can manipulate this system because all the internal protections are gone. And that's where, you know, I just don't want people thinking that we can get rid of Bill Barr and the problem is solved. No, we have deep structural problems within this agency, and that has to be acknowledged in order to truly reform it, because you can't fix something if you're not identifying what's really wrong.
And when whistleblowers don't have any protection, and when the president can go on air and has the arrogance and the belief that he can go on air, and he does go on air and demand his name be said, and then I don't remember which news items did, but some news people put right. Whistleblowers name out there in the public. But the whole point of whistleblower protections were to protect us, the American citizens, from corruption within
exactly.
within our government, so that we can know what's happening, so that we can find out the truth. But, you know, look what they're doing to, I don't want to get into a long talk about it, but Assange and Chelsea Manning. You know, Chelsea Manning's still sitting in probably, they like to lock her in solitary, and she's sitting there because she won't lie and say that Assange did something he didn't do. And Assange is there because he published information he got about our government. All of those things should not be being punished. You know, that people, they never tell you it's not the problem was that you heard a lie. No, the problem was we heard the truth about our government, and there are people in our government who don't want that change. Clearly, Barr is one of those, and I think in the last few days they've talked more closely about trying to close down the system so that it's only loyal people reporting to the president. I can't see anything short of the election turning this around, and then it has to be someone who's elected who really believes in turning it around. I don't think Obama did. We just discussed that about how he did not make changes he could. And without a president who's very strongly committed to changing it, it's going to be harder than heck.
Right, absolutely. And it's really going to take Congress reasserting its authority. I mean, part of the problem is Congress has weakened itself over the decades. When I was working on a number of pieces of legislation that would have improved whistleblower protections, it was very frustrating to talk to people, especially representing the intelligence committees, about how they need that information from whistleblowers, and they didn't want it. You know, they would actually say,
"Ooh, don't show me
information from the officials. We don't want whistleblowers coming to us." And now, you know, begging the president not to retaliate against these whistleblowers, not to name them publicly, that would allow greater retaliation. You could have written that law. That was in the law.
Yeah.
We could have put that in the law, and then you wouldn't have to be begging.
Yes.
It was frustrating a lot of the debate because it was saying, this you should act this way. No, the law should require protection of these whistleblowers, and unfortunately they did not step up when it was appropriate. You know,
well,
Congress has a right to receive information from the executive branch about how it is exercising its authority, and when it would voluntarily give up that right, it shouldn't then expect that it can demand it at a time and get it. And unfortunately, we're suffering the repercussions of those decisions made decades ago.
Well, and the continued pushing of them forward, the unitary president and all of that has been pushed forward dramatically since 2000, really. You know, just in this millennium, in our new millennium, we're pushing that forward. And I think we're at a very, probably the most dangerous time in history that I can remember. This election feels like, and I don't know how to say why it feels like it, but it feels like the 1968 election when Robert Kennedy was still alive. I came to Portland to see him and had Secret Service walk over my shoulders to get on the stage. But nonetheless, there was something about that. And I have a this one feels very, I'm not talking about there's going to be an assassination, but just how important it is and how weighted and how divided we are as a populace. And I'm not one for unity. I want unity around what? I want unity around the right ideals, not just unity for unity's sake. So thank you so much for joining us, Mike. Any last thing you want to say?
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, you're very welcome.
Sort of getting back to the caller who talked about local things, I mean, one of the things that I think it's frustrating what's happening in the federal government, and we have to use our local and state governments to protect our rights and the rights of our neighbors. And I think that is sort of the opposite of the civil rights movement when it was state governments that were refusing to protect the constitutional rights of their residents, that the federal government stepped in.
All right.
We have to encourage our local and state governments to protect us because the federal government is not.
All right. Well, thank you for that, and thanks again for coming on today, Mike German. This is Linda Olson-Osterlund signing off for Thursday Morning Talk Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Act Now on Climate Emergency, Thursday, February 27th, 4 to 7 p.m. at Portland City Hall. This climate emergency rally will demand annual steps to reduce carbon emissions by at least 8% each year and to end Zenith tar sand oil exports. Enjoy street theater, music, and a puppet show. Again, Act on Climate Emergency this Thursday, 4 to 7 p.m., City Hall, 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue. More information can be found at kboo.fm's homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland.